Welcome to the Global Governance Podcast, where we explore the future of governance. Each episode will look at a different global issue and how governance plays a key role in its solution. From climate change to gender equality, from corruption to peace and security, we invite experts to explore a thought-provoking game of what if and why not, positing a world in much closer international cooperation. And now your host, Augusto López Claros. Enjoy.
Daniel Dudney teaches political science, international relations, and political theory at Johns Hopkins University. He holds a BA in philosophy and political science from Yale University and a PhD in political science from Princeton University. He was a senior researcher at the World Watch Institute in Washington, D.C., and more recently was a senior research fellow at the Transatlantic Academy of the German Marshall Fund in the United States. His areas of interest are general international relations theory, world political theory, and then contemporary global issues, such as nuclear, outer space, environment, and energy. He has a distinguished publication record. His book, Bounding Power, was winner of prizes from the American Political Science Association and was co-winner of the Book of the Decade Award from the International Studies Association. His most recent book is Dark Skies, Space Expansionism, Planetary Geopolitics, and the Ends of Humanity. Thank you, Daniel, for speaking to us today. We are delighted that you have agreed to participate in this podcast. I would like to begin our discussion by reference to a recent article of yours on the nuclear political debate, Planetary Geopolitics and Arms Control. In that article, you refer to what you call the sort of nuclear political question, namely, what political arrangements are needed to preserve security and liberty in the nuclear age? A vital question, it seems to me, as nuclear security is very much tied to the capabilities of a nation state. You describe how this seemingly simple concept remains rather complex, in fact. I found this discussion really very insightful, interesting, as it opens conversations into broader areas of our so-called state-centric world order and the impact of technology in particular. To tackle this question, you introduce three concepts: repair, reform, and revolution. For our listeners, can you please briefly outline each of these notions and their geopolitical implications?
Thank you for having me. That's a lot of question there. And I refer to this debate, which has been going on since the end of the Second World War, since the beginning of the atomic age, as the nuclear political debate. And it's the simple question that it's attempting to address, which is, given the reality of the possibility of nuclear destruction, what kind of political arrangements, what world order do we want to have to maintain security from nuclear destruction? And, of course, the striking thing about this debate is that it's been going on, you know, for 75, 80 years, and it's very much unresolved. There are strong positions on all different sides. And the ability to distinguish which of these views is correct on the basis of empirical information is extremely limited. You know, there's this famous line in the Dr. Strangelove movie where the character playing the president of the United States says, "General, I fought as many nuclear wars as you have," which is to say zero. So we're talking about something, an event, and the probability of an event, which has never occurred. And so the question is why? And we have all these different explanations. And so it's very difficult to empirically resolve this debate. And that means that in a sense, we're all, you know, doing some type of deductive theory. And of course, what's happened is that we've extrapolated stuff that went on in the past, previous historical experiences and arrangements. And we basically projected that into the nuclear, you know, situation, the nuclear age, and generated all sorts of, let's do this, no, do that, build this, no, have that strategy. And so we are basically talking about comparative deductive theories, sort of comparative political imaginaries, in a sense, that are extrapolations from the past. And so given all of this, you know, my starting point is to sort of say, well, we have to sort of step back and actually look at it, you know, just empirically, descriptively, you know, in the most simple and basic terms, and then go from there. And when one does that, this is to say we have to look at what the nuclear situation actually is. You know, what is the contours of this as a threat to our security? And when you do that, I mean, I think most people's, you know, reaction at some level is that this is comic, that there's a ridiculous character to this situation, that there's an absurdity. And one way to capture, you know, that sort of basic intuitive reaction to it is this. Imagine that the planet is like a house and our yard and gardens, right? Our property where we live, right? And over time, you know, we have built this house and we've made this property better in various ways, and it's commodious for us and all this infrastructure. And we have also built a self-demolition device. It's as if we've built a house that has, you know, crates of dynamite, you know, here and there, all wired together, and with one person having the ability to push the button. And so there's a looking at this from the standpoint of the human species and all of this conversation about catastrophic and existential risk, you know, is it going to be an asteroid striking the Earth? Will runaway climate change, you know, do us in? Pandemics, whole list of possibilities. And on that list is obviously still nuclear weapons. And nuclear weapons is different from the others in that it's so transparently an act of suicide. And so we don't really need to look at the benefits for future generations, as important as they are. What we need to do is not commit suicide and basically come up with steps to take the crates of dynamite that we've strategically placed around our house and radically reduce the probabilities of it detonating, greatly shrink it and alter the command and employment capabilities and sequences. And that's all we can do. And so we should think of it as a kind of, well, this is like home improvement. This is like, you know, what we do to our domicile so that we do not commit suicide with it.
Thank you, Daniel, for that very interesting analysis. I find your analogy of the house with the explosives distributed throughout, you know, a very compelling imagery. I hope you won't mind if I use it actually in some of my own presentations.
Just always cite me.
In the article, you describe how the great nuclear debate has existed in a sequence of phases. Currently, you claim that we are in the bombs away phase, which emphasizes the threat of non-state actors and a kind of a weakened confidence and deterrence. What particularly strikes me about this phase, as you describe it, is the division between arms controls experts over how to govern nuclear security without deterrence as a stabilizing force. you explain how war strategy and arms control have become increasingly radicalized, with some even advocating for a limited use of nuclear weapons and others at the other end of the spectrum, you know, calling for complete disarmament. How are the ideas of this bombs away phase different, or in some respect, a continuation of previous theoretical approaches to nuclear security? If these theories are correct, in the absence of nuclear deterrence, how do states maintain nuclear security?
That's another big cluster of really important questions. And so I think that this debate, you know, can be broken into these phases. And I think that other people have said this, and that there's been a recognition that in the years since the end of the Cold War, things have changed. And the change has been against the baseline of the Cold War, or at least of a understanding or idealized understanding of the Cold War that seemed to suggest that deterrence, you know, was a viable means of solving the problem. But since the end of the Cold War, as you say, we've had these concerns of non-state actors. We talk about proliferation to multiple states and leakage to non-state actors. And the potential, you know, of leakage is enormous. You know, how much nuclear material is there in the world? How many nuclear weapons are there in the world? Thousands of nuclear weapons. And so, you know, how secure are these? 99% secure, indefinitely, everywhere? This is a government program, of course, that's doing this. And are we saying that we have built a government arrangement that's going to be 99% successful? It's utopian. To think that the status quo, you know, is viable, given this notion of leakage. And, you know, continuing down the list, you basically then say the system is fundamentally unstable. It can't stay the way it is. Something's going to change. And, you know, in the case of the leakage, what do we do after we have a nuclear detonation? From, you know, perhaps some group that won't even claim. What if we wake up tomorrow and Washington, D.C. is not there anymore? What are we going to think about this nuclear question then? What are the kinds of things that we're going to expect and demand after that? And so I think it's always useful to sort of game these scenarios out. And of course, that's all what we've been doing all along. We've never had a nuclear war, so all the things that we think about a nuclear war are essentially extrapolations, model-generated, you know, images. And there is still the next point here to be made apropos your question is that the declining faith in deterrence. And of course, you know, that's a matter of degrees. But, you know, we have all of these, we have this handful of revisionist states or pariah states that have large arsenals. We have conflicts, you know, India and Pakistan between nuclear states. So we basically have all these additional places where a nuclear war might start, where nuclear weapons might be used. And at the same time that that's going on, the United States has been pushing forward with the so-called modernization of its strategic nuclear forces to make them ever more usable. And some American analysts claim that the United States has or is within easy reach of a disarming first strike capability. And so the contrast between now and the earlier Cold War period is that there's more places that it could start, right? It's more complicated. And we then just have to make judgments as to, you know, what the probability of these types of things occurring are. And, you know, thinking about the probability of this kind of stuff, it hasn't happened, so we have no empirical base. But we do have instances in which we've had these crises, and people involved in the crises, you know, have come out of them and said things like John F. Kennedy after the Cuban Missile Crisis. Well, he thought that it was a 1 in 2 and 1 in 3 chance of going to general nuclear war. And given what we now know that he didn't know, the probability was surely even higher than he thought. And so you ask yourself, well, you got an international system that's going to have a crisis in which there's going to be something like that probability of nuclear war. How frequently? Every 50 years, you know? And so, you know, this is a gamble. We're basically, you know, playing this game, a very dangerous game of roulette with this system. And, you know, how lucky are we? How smart are we, alternatively, to put the gun down? And so that takes me to the last part of your question, which is, what about this disagreement, you know, about what the end state looks like? And the sort of simple model, again, you got to think very basically, is that you basically have a house or a room in which there are different people that have armed themselves. And what you have to do is you basically have to have symmetrical, transparent disarmament, which we have case studies of. We've done this, you know, not overall, but instances. And then you basically have to institutionalize the nuclear command, the nuclear authority. And I think the fundamental objective is to lengthen the fuse. And when the fuse is lengthened, you can have non-despotic decision-making. You can have a Republican check and balance, concurrent authority arrangement. And what I would add, and this is something that most people who think about this don't say, is that part of the problem is that nuclear weapons are out of sight, out of mind. We have these near misses. We have a learning period, and then we forget. And so part of a regime of nuclear stability would be, in a sense, a program of nuclear public education. And this would, of course, ideally, everyone in every school would learn basic facts about nuclear weapons. But at the level of the political order, the world order, you would have ceremonial and ritual events. They can be of many different types, but one might be to every so often detonate a small nuclear weapon and have the leaders of the states that are members of the Nuclear Security Confederation sit up close.
Daniel, as you were responding, I was thinking of Article 6 of the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, which, as you know, asks countries to pursue negotiations in good faith on the effective cessation of nuclear arms, the nuclear arms race, and then to go on a process of nuclear disarmament. And as your answer makes, you know, very clear, instead, we have taken no steps towards disarmament, and in fact, we are expanding our arsenals. But let me sort of go on and ask you another question. In your work, you emphasize the importance of scientific and technological revolutions in the development of nuclear weapons. You specifically highlight something that you call the vulnerability revolution, which is the increase in knowledge about the Earth and the environmental consequences of nuclear weapons. You argue, and I totally agree with you, that we have a much better understanding today of why nuclear war would be, as you state, an act of assured suicide via a biospheric murder, because nuclear weapons contribute to biospheric collapse, fallout, nuclear winter, and related nightmares, which incidentally were very compellingly described some 40 years ago by Jonathan Schell in The Fate of the Earth. So by showcasing the highly detrimental effects of nuclear weapons use on our habitat, this revolution would seem to undermine or question the benefits of scientific advances which empower our nuclear war-making capacities. How does this knowledge contribute to systems of deterrence among nuclear powers? Do you foresee countries or international bodies moving in the direction of imposing restrictions on nuclear weapons, testing use, et cetera, because of these findings?
To start at the top, we talk about the nuclear revolution, but we should recognize that this has been one of a cluster of revolutions. And of course, this language of revolution, you know, is used promiscuously. And, you know, we have the revolutionary new automobile tires, and we have the revolutionary new garment of some sort. But I think that the concept of revolution is valuable. And you would start by saying that a revolution, something to be qualify for a revolution, is you have to have something that relates to human practical, you know, activity in an important way that increases in capabilities by multiple orders of magnitude. And so, obviously, nuclear weapons are revolutionary because they are, in comparative terms, from dynamite to thermonuclear weapons, they are seven to eight orders of magnitude larger. A second revolution, which has actually been essential to the construction of this bomb in our house, has been a transportation revolution. You know, we went from gunpowder, TNT, nuclear explosives. That took, you know, several centuries, but in the case of transportation, the beginning of the 20th century, the fastest transportation was the 20 to 30 miles. And by the middle of the 20th century, we had transportation capabilities that could deliver objects anywhere on the planet in half an hour, which is, again, many orders of magnitude larger. And then we've also had a revolution in information. We all know about this, of course. This really started with the telegraph. That was the big move. Prior to the telegraph, you had to carry messages for out-of-sight communication. So communication was as fast as transportation, which was very slow. And then in an instant, technologically, we went to an approximation of the speed of light. That was a revolution. Now, all that's happened really since then is that the bandwidth has enormously increased. Right? No longer just dot and dash, instead terabytes of information flooding through these conduits. And it's these three things combined, the exploitation of these three possibilities, that is actually the Armageddon gadget, the actual apparatus that we have built that we have to dismantle and reconfigure. Now, alongside those revolutions in technology, science-based technology, there has been another revolution that largely coincidentally, not entirely, occurred during the same period as the development of the nuclear. And that is the revolution in Earth system science. We basically understand the Earth now in a radically different way than it was understood, say, in the 1930s and 40s and before. And this is appropriately called a revolution because its magnitude, its comprehensivity, and its implications, it's like the revolution in nuclear physics, right, that occurred late 19th, early 20th century, and earlier the revolution in cosmology, astronomy, Copernicus is running through Newton. Right. So we live on a new Earth. We understand that this Earth that we live on, we see it in a completely new way now. And this would be a larger conversation, and this is something that we should always be focusing on, not just with regard to nuclear weapons, but with regard to all of these different questions, of course, particularly climate change. And first reality that we have to acknowledge is that we do not really understand it in important ways. We don't have a full account for why the Earth actually is habitable. And we've been attempting to reconstruct the planetary, you know, history, and it's had a lot of near misses. You know, we've had ice ball Earths, right? We've had asteroidal collisions. We've had giant die-offs because of carbon loading in the atmosphere, right? And so the Earth as a habitat for humanity, you know, is very much a mixed bag. And in the course of understanding the character of this Earth system science, we also discovered that a significant nuclear war, and I underscore here that it's not simply nuclear weapons per se, or even the occasional testing of nuclear weapons. It's instead the significant use of nuclear weapons for military purposes. And the crucial element here is fires, okay? The harms to the environment, there are multiple, but one of the key vectors is fires. Which inject enormous quantities of material into the atmosphere, soot, you know, creating, therefore, the nuclear winter, right? And the other would be the complete destruction of the ozone layer, which would allow massively increased levels of ultraviolet B radiation to reach the surface of the Earth. What will that do to all of these different life forms? Well, it's not going to be good. We could potentially sterilize, you know, large chunks of the larger life support system. And so we came to realize that not only had we built a bomb that would blow up our house, we also came to realize that if we did blow up our house, it would significantly perturb and damage the garden within which our house, you know, sits, our yard, our grounds. And so, you know, we talked earlier about this analogy of the house. You know, you also here would want to talk about an analogy of that you are in a spaceship. You know, Buckminster Fuller used this language of spaceship Earth. Others did as well during the 60s and early 70s. It's a very pregnant and insightful, not completely insightful, image, because it does capture the fact that the planet, you know, is this isolated entity in this larger space that's fundamentally hostile to it in major ways. But one of the things about a spaceship is that you eventually are going to have to operate it in some fashion. And we don't have an operating manual. It didn't come with an operating manual. But I think that in terms of the getting back to the nuclear, one kind of thing that one can clearly say is you wouldn't want to put a big bomb in it, right? So it's not just that we have a house, that we are in a spaceship. that we've wired for self-demolition. And if the demolition occurs, you know, the viability of the spaceship to provide us, you know, a habitat to live in could be fatally compromised.
Thank you, Daniel. To address the changing landscape of nuclear arms control, you draw on the concept of an expression that perhaps will be new to many of our listeners, nuclear one-worldism 2.0, which is a modification of the concept of nuclear one-worldism, or NOW, that was prominent in the early Cold War period. As you explain, this concept contends that nuclear weapons question the security provider function of the state, and the creation of a world government remains the only way to prevent another nuclear catastrophe. A concept that I have often associated with the likes of Albert Einstein, Bertrand Russell, Grenville Clark, and others. As I understand it, the new NOW updates this view by arguing that maybe a new world order need not be based on a singular world state. To elaborate on this, what was the historical importance of NOW? And how do the differentiations in NOW 2.0 fit into this modern-day nuclear landscape?
Yeah, that's a meaty question as well. Nuclear one-worldism is an expression that I started using maybe 20 years ago to refer to a body of thought in the early nuclear era. And this is something that everyone who thinks about the nuclear topic generally should know, because when this stuff was first invented, there was a very strong body of thought that said, well, this has essentially rendered the security viability of the nation state to be moot or to be fundamentally compromised. And a striking feature of many of these formulations of this nuclear one-worldist diagnosis came from people that were leading realists, leading practitioners and thinkers of the tradition of realpolitik. Hans Morgenthau was a nuclear one-worlder. Right? John Herz was a nuclear one-worlder. And when you look at the arguments that are made, and these are, you know, developed, you know, international relations theory arguments, basically what they say is that the state across time, you know, had the project, its purpose, its animating goal was to provide security within a particular territorial space. And that over time, there had been a major trend in that the size of the units that you were capable of securing kept increasing. And then nuclear weapons came along. And nuclear weapons are just doing the same thing that had been done before at a different scale. Another way of putting this is that the interstate system is understood to be anarchical, in the sense of lacking authoritative arrangement. Now, we have this long discourse, you know, of thinking about the state of nature and about, you know, anarchy. And basically, in these arguments, the most important variable, the most important concept, if you would, that sits at the heart of Western thinking about political order, really, is what I refer to as violence interdependence. And violence interdependence is very simple. It's the capacity of actors to do damage to one another, irregardless of the distribution of power, or holding that constant. And so you can think about, you know, the evolution of history is that initially we're in a room and everyone has knives and pens. Some have more or less. But the level of violence interdependence in that space is defined by the capacity of the pencils and pens to wreak harm. Not very much. Okay, so it's weak. Then we have a technological transformation in the same space. We have guns. We could have a knife stage, then we go to guns. So we get to the gun stage, and you know, people have got guns, some have more or less than others. But the level of violence interdependence in that space is defined by the ability of guns to cause absolute harm to the others in this space. Imagine a further technological transformation where we have grenades and machine guns. Some have more, some have less. But the capacity of those machine guns and grenades to wreak violence determines the situation of violence interdependence. It's intense now. They can readily kill one another. And the main claim at the very beginning of Western thought about political order is in situations where everyone can readily kill one another, you have to exit anarchy. You have to have an effective arrangement for the regulation of violence, right? And we've been doing that at larger and larger scales across history. So this takes us to the nuclear era. And so, you know, Hans Morgenthau and John Hurst, these early nuclear one-worlders, are basically saying, look, you know, gunpowder made the feudal fief obsolete. You know, the Industrial Revolution, you know, made these smaller nation states obsolete, as demonstrated in the Second World War. But nuclear weapons have now rendered inviolable even these continental size units, the United States and the Soviet Union. And so we have to exit from anarchy. That's the first point. The second point is to what? What do we do when we exit anarchy? And the general tendency among the nuclear one-worlders, the early ones, the nuclear one-worldism 1.0, was to say that we wanted to have a world government in the sense of a world state, that there would be some entity on the planet that would have a monopoly of legitimate violence. And then, of course, they talked about all sorts of different variations, you know, within that arrangement. Now, the reality is that the willingness of people on the earth to generate peacefully a world state is extremely low. Right? We look at world politics and we see all these different advocacies and interests and so on. We see no one advocating a world state. And the capacity of existing actors to resist the formation of a world state, should someone attempt it, is extremely high. So there's a sense in which the state solution set is just fundamentally mismatched to the planetary global scale nuclear governance problem. And another way of seeing how this is so is to recognize that these entities that we call states across time and all their many varieties and imperfections and incompletenesses, right, they were doing two things. On the one hand, they were providing an internal order. Right? They had left anarchy. Violence was regulated to some first approximation within this space. But the other thing that they were doing is they were attempting to secure their space from outside actors, right? They existed within this larger system in which there was no arrangement of protection. There was no authoritative government. There was no effective arms control. And so over time, a set of practices, and I call these the real state mode of protection, emerged to concentrate power, to render it autonomous, to mobilize it, right? All for purposes of employment against outside threats. look then at the world situation. What if we had a world government? What if we created a world state? The task of securing from the outside, this barring colonization of space and aliens, is absent. It can't be a problem. And so there's a sense in which a world government of some sort would be radically unlike the situation of all previous governments, with the exception, say, of Easter Island or, you know, far-flung islands that didn't have interaction with peoples elsewhere. Because it doesn't need a foreign policy. It doesn't need a foreign and defense policy. Right? And so all of those things, the mobilization, the concentration, and the rendering autonomous for purposes of employment that have defined the state, the real state mode of protection, are solutions to a problem that doesn't exist. Right? Another way of thinking about the question of governance that I think sheds light on where we want to go is the recognition that the basic realist, you know, typology, if you would, of order in which you have islands of hierarchy, you know, islands of sovereign authority within a sea of anarchy, right, that is significantly incomplete. And that across historical time, we can see a substantial other set of arrangements, never by any means dominant, but certainly present. And this is about republicanism and the idea being that you have restrained government, mutual restraints increasingly thickened. And so you kind of think of the states as billiard balls. Because of the nuclear revolution, the billiard balls have been converted into eggs. So they can't crash into each other like they used to, except to have catastrophic outcomes. So what do? The eggs in anarchy. They start cobwebs initially, then strings, then ropes and cables to sort of tie themselves to one another symmetrically so that they don't bang against each other. In effect, to sort of accrete an institutional egg carton of negations, of restraints, not of empowerments, not of authoritative empowerments. And so I think about the alternative here as being a third point on a triangle. Okay, you got the anarchy rising up to hierarchy, an axis that's vertical. But then a triangular formation where there is a third of a republican form of unions, and then, of course, you have three spectra. And what we have been doing with arms control, right? We've done a lot of arms control. We have all of these institutions. We have all of these treaties. We've done all of these things, right? They are not steps towards the empowerment of a world sovereign. They are instead first steps towards this egg carton, right? Towards a full union of mutual restraint. And so, you know, that's my particular take on it. But when you look at the conversation that has occurred, you know, in recent years, you do, as you mentioned, have a very strong zero advocacy position. And there has been a conversation about what zero looks like. And I think that the key idea that really Jonathan Schell, you know, deserves main credit for is that you're essentially increasing the length of the fuse. Right? That you can't get rid of the possibility of nuclear weapons. And so it's a question of how we reconstruct the path from where one is to where to when nuclear weapons are used. And so this entails a vision of not zero as the world minus nuclear weapons, but rather an image in which the existing giant infrastructures, organizations, materials, you know, sensors, transportation systems, all of this has basically been radically shrunk, first of all, but then reconfigured to be a type of deep arms control in that sense. And I would also note that this is related to a lot of the previous points that we've been talking about here, is that while arms control is in important ways declining now, it has had major successes, and that much of the world is actually strongly in favor of zero nuclear, and they have demonstrated this with their support for the Ban Treaty and also joining nuclear free zones. And so we need to continue to think about what we want to do next as the further steps of these things that we've done that are on an axis not leading to a world government in the sense of a world state, but rather leading towards deeper and deeper, more institutionalized, co-designed arms control.
Daniel, in a way, you have anticipated my next question. When I was reading your paper, I was actually captivated by a statement that you make where you say, and I quote, superpower violence capabilities within the confines of the terrestrial Earth combined with anarchic political patterns is fundamentally incompatible with security and an exit from anarchy into an authoritative potential political order is required. I fully endorse that view, and thank you for putting it in such cogent and interesting way. To bring this very interesting conversation to an end, I want to bring us to this particular precarious geopolitical moment characterized by Russia's unprovoked war in the Ukraine, rumblings about war in East Asia linked to Taiwan, all against the background of something that you referred to before, which is accelerating climate change. Relations between the two major nuclear powers are at their lowest point since the days of the Cold War. The killing, cruelty, chaos, destruction that we see in Ukraine, as we speak in recent days and weeks and months, has heightened tensions. And there has been, as you know, irresponsible talk about the possible use of nuclear weapons by Russia. This at a time when we face multiple catastrophic risks on various fronts, which cannot be addressed outside of a framework of much stronger international cooperation. So to conclude, Daniel, give our listeners and followers, many of whom are people under 30, some reason for hope as we contemplate this very complicated landscape over the next several years.
Well, that's, of course, a type of concern that anyone who thinks about these topics is invariably, grapples with pessimism, optimism, hope. My thought on this, to abstract, from the current situation a bit, but just to acknowledge with regard to the current situation that, as you say, we are in a very dangerous situation. We are sliding backward with regard to many problems. The demand for global solutions is rising at a time when the capacity for even local, regional, let alone global solutions seems to be if not fully declining, declining in some places and significantly weakening in others. And given this, we have to recognize that, as people have used this language, a polycrisis is the reality, that we have also the possibilities of further pandemics, the world economy, you know, who knows, but if the global financial system is, you know, rickety and in some important ways. And given all of this, you know, are we doomed? The answer is not necessarily. But it positive outcomes depend upon mobilized human agencies. And we are basically now in a planetary emergency. And our prospects for weathering this, for sort of pushing through in a successful way, is dependent upon people rising to act. You know, here I might bring in another sort of analogy that perhaps valuable. I talked about, you know, spaceship Earth earlier, and I talked about the domestic, the house, the garden earlier. But another image of our contemporary situation that also is resonant with most fundamental insight is the notion that the ship, and of course the ship of state, you know, has been central to our thinking about government. The word government actually comes from the Latin word for steer, as in a boat, operate a rudder. The way I think of it is that for most of human history, humans were on separate, slow-moving streams and tributaries, interacting with people on other little clusters of debris and rafts and proto-ships that were being built slowly over these vastly different places. And that over the last five centuries, all of these proto-rafts and proto-ships and clusters of debris have all slammed into each other. And it's now this one big mess, a global debris mat. Okay? We're not on spaceship Earth. We are on spaceship Earth, but in terms of the way we have it organized, it's like a debris mat. We're not on top of this. And people will say, oh, well, we need to build a ship. Yeah, that's probably not going to be possible. It might be undesirable. Our most realistic aspiration is to have a raft craft. We have to basically convert this impinged cluster of rafts and debris and so forth, in which humans, you know, are, you know, as if the tiniest ants moving around on and altering incrementally. We have to build raft capacities. And this is another way of saying that this can be done in pieces. This is a series of pieces. And everyone needs to start thinking of themselves and acting as though they are a member of a crew and start going around and making this operation more, if not fully ship-shaped, raft shape, right? And so what this means is at multiple levels. With regard to climate, of course, it means personal decarbonization, immediate community decarbonization. With regard to peace and with regard to this nuclear question, you know, it means active support for the existing organizations and actors and politicians, okay? The political system is responsive. And we've had earlier instances in which mass popular concern about nuclear weapons pushed state policy in significantly positive directions. And that's an important accomplishment that we need to recognize and copy. Do it again. So if we act, I'm hopeful.
Thank you for listening to the Global Governance Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with friends and family. To learn more, please visit globalgovernanceforum.org and join the conversation.